This morning I have great pleasure in introducing to you Dr. Carl Barth, President of Concordia Seminary. Dr. Barth.
Thanks very much, Dr. Fremder. I know that these few words of welcome are very, very tardy and late, but nevertheless, I asked Dr. Fremder if I could come in and just say a few words to you. A week or so ago, I was out at the War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, the Army War College, and spent a week in a national security seminar. And at the end of the week, they asked our reactions to it, what we thought about it. And I told them the little story about the 17th century bishop who got angry with his dog one day and threw a stone at the dog and hit his mother-in-law. And his comment was, while the mission was not accomplished, the effort was not entirely wasted. Nasty way with all these ladies present to start the day, but we certainly hope that your effort here will not be wasted either, and that, in fact, indeed, the mission will be accomplished. As musicians, you are much more familiar, I'm sure, than I with all the statements of Father Luther about music, placing music next to theology and saying that next to the Word of God, music should be placed as the queen and mistress of all the emotions of the human heart. Well, why did he speak like that? Not simply because he liked music or that he himself was a musician, but because Luther saw music as another vehicle for the gospel. To chase away evil thoughts, as he spoke of it so often, depression, the devil, and to remind us of the goodness of God and his mercy in Jesus Christ the Savior. And that's why he has stated that all those who should be ordained in the ministry ought to study music. So it's no small wonder then that in 1839, if you've gone by our little log cabin, and I don't know what your backgrounds are, how much you know about the history of this place, but when that little log cabin opened in Perry County on that cold day in December 1839 with the 11 students, age 5 1/2 to 15, they not only had included in the curriculum 6 languages, German, English, Latin, French, Hebrew, Greek, and not only math, physics, philosophy, natural history, drawing, but also music. So it's a very great heritage that we have also here at Concordia Seminary. And I'm especially grateful to Dr. Fremder for arranging this music workshop, to those of you who are serving as our guest lecturers and leaders, and to all of you for coming. And it is a great pleasure to extend welcome to you on behalf of the seminary family. We know that you've come so that by the grace of God, you also can be better equipped to lead God's people through music into the worship and the praise of our Creator, Redeemer, and Sanctifier. And so we wish you a very pleasant and a very enriching stay here. Thank you.
Perhaps I ought to preface what I have to say by perhaps pointing out some of the, or asking the question, where are the sources? How do we know the liturgical practice in Leipzig of Bach's day? The first book that you must have is Günter Stiller. What's it? I did have something to do with it, but I can't remember the title. Liturgical Life in Leipzig at the Time of Bach, that's it. I've only lived so close to it for so long that I can't even remember the title. Actually, the title was changing the whole time we were working on the manuscript, so that's probably the reason for my ambivalence. That was an excellent book, and I worked very hard to get a publisher, and it turned out to be CPH, to publish it, because it is a very fine piece of work, and it traces the very rich devotional liturgical life that was existing in Leipzig at the time of Bach and just before Bach got there. In Kuhnau's time, the if you like, the liturgical renewal, though it didn't need renewing because it was already there. But it was renewed in the sense that it was expanding. Now, what happened during the 18th century was the beginnings of the inroads of rationalism, and what was happening is that in other places, other Lutheran centres, the liturgical worship was beginning to be eroded and beginning to fall apart, but not in Leipzig. Leipzig was one of the last places where orthodoxy held out against the twin forces of Pietism with a big P and the Aufklärung, the Enlightenment. And what happened was that in 1539, in Saxony, and Leipzig then was in Saxony, still is, there was published an Agendenbuch, in 1539, largely based on, as you would expect anyway, but I have already told you, so you ought to know, based on the Formula Missae of Luther and the Deutsche Messe. The following year, 1540, it was expanded, expanded by the addition of various liturgical prayers and more of the same, really. The basic liturgy remained the same, but it was more prayers, collects, and so on were added to it. And that basic edition was reprinted again and again and again throughout Saxony, in Dresden, and Leipzig. And in Leipzig, it continued to be reprinted, complete with the preface from Justus Jonas and Caspar Kreuziger and others. The whole lot completely reprinted without any changes whatsoever, at least as late as 1771, which really is quite late. By that stage, other towns and places had given up on liturgical worship. But the basic Saxon agenda continues in use in Leipzig and is reprinted again and again, and it's the one that Bach had to work with. But the Agendenbuch didn't give you the full liturgy. Now, I am an Anglican by background, and therefore I am used to having a prayer book which spells out all the details in the various points. In our prayer book, you start at page 1 and you go to page 2, page 3, and it is all consecutive, all the details there. Lutheran liturgy, traditionally, has always been a kit of parts. You have a description of what the liturgy is and what it shall contain, but then there are many variables, and those variables are not put in at that point. They are collected together in other places, and if you look at the older Agendenbuchs, you'll find that you have a description of the liturgy, of the kind of thing it is, not a detailed working out. You couldn't use that description. You have to work at it yourself. But it gives you, under various headings, it gives you all the ingredients, or most of the ingredients, not all of them, that you use in the liturgy. So therefore you cannot go to the Saxon again in the book and say, that was in use, that's all we need. Okay, because things like hymns are not there, things like the Kyrie and Gloria are not included there, so you have to go to other sources. For Bach's day, you need to go to Vopelius Neue Leipziger Gesangbuch of 1682. That gives you the hymns that were used in Leipzig in Bach's day, throughout Bach's day. It was the chorale book used by the choir, used by the organist. All the tunes are given with figured bass. If you do the comparisons with some of the concluding chorales in Bach's cantatas, you will find that if you do your homework carefully, and if you have a copy of the 1682 book, you can see that Bach has begun with Vopelius, with a melody, which he accepts from Vopelius, and don't be misled. You often see comments that Bach was responsible for ruining the rhythmic versions of the chorales and squaring them up into isometric forms. That had already happened by Bach's day. It's all there in Vopelius, and he uses that melodic form. He begins by using the bass, But then when he wants to change the harmonies inside the inner voices he starts writing out, he finds that he has to change the bass as well. And it's very in many cases, or a good many cases, those closing chorales begin, his starting point is Vopelius. So it was a working book for Bach. Also in Vopelius, there are various bits and pieces of liturgical material, such as the Passion, the Passions of Volta, dating from 1550 or thereabouts, the John Passion for, the Matthew Passion for Palm Sunday Gospel, and the John Passion for the Gospel for the day on Good Friday. And be sure that you understand that the gospel for the day at the Hauptgottesdienst, the main worship on Good Friday, the gospel for the day was the plain song mass, plain song Passion of Volta, which was sung in the morning. John Passion, the old plain song, or quasi plain song, and then in the afternoon at Vespers, that's when you heard Bach's John Passion, for example, or the Matthew Passion. Also in Vopelius there are the versicles and responses, the certum corda for ferial use, simple plain song, but also festal use in six parts for the choir. And it also has liturgical pieces such as the Kyrie, the Gloria, and so on. Then you also have a little book called, I think it's 1692 or 1694, Leipziger Kirchen and Dachten, which is a little devotional book for the laity to bring along with them to church. It doesn't have a complete liturgy in it, but it has hymns and it has devotions. It has prayers to be said during the cantata, suggestions of what you should pray while you are listening to the cantata that's being performed, and at the time of the distribution, when you're waiting your turn or after you've received, then there are prayers for that. But also there are liturgical bits and pieces and hymns in that little book as well, and some explanation of the observances throughout the church year, the special things that apply to Leipzig. Then there was another little book, a very similar book, Leipziger Kirchenstaat, STAAT. This was published in 1710, and that had a similar purpose as the Leipziger Kirchen and Dachten. Devotional handbooks for the congregation. But they only had very few hymns. There wasn't a hymnal, a Leipzig hymnal, until I think it's 1729. They used all kinds of hymns, but they used a basic core repertory that they knew by heart anyway. So the hymnals, until that point, were not absolutely necessary. And then the most useful piece of evidence that we have for Leipzig is there's a manuscript begun, I think, in 1714 by the Custos, the custodian, the sexton of St. Thomas's Church, in which he records the peculiar practices, or the particular practices of Leipzig, the liturgical colors, what hymns were sung on what day, what liturgical observances there were on these particular days. And it is a notebook that he compiled clearly when he took the job, so that he wouldn't forget from year to year. And Leipzig was incredibly conservative. They did the same thing in the same way on the same observance every year, or every time that observance came round. And Rost just puts these notes in that notebook. And when any changes do get made, then he puts those changes in and the dates when they changed. So for instance, we know that it was in 1721 that there was the first Oratorio Passion was heard in Leipzig, Kuhnau's Marcus Passion. It's recorded there in Rost. And Rost also tells us when I can't tell you the date offhand, I don't remember it, but it also tells you when the first time that a concerted Passion was used at Vespers in St. Thomas and St. Nicholas in Leipzig. And so it's a very, very useful source. Unfortunately, it is a manuscript that exists only in Leipzig. And it's very difficult to get at. The East Germans don't like Westerners looking at precious things. And especially if it has church connections, there are certain difficulties attached to it. And Gunther Stiller is an East German pastor. He ministers in Stralsund, near Rostock in the north of the country, and he has incredible difficulty doing his research. Those of you who've read the book very carefully will have picked up the footnote that he is working, this was 1966 when he wrote that as a dissertation, he is working on a second volume which will do what I'm very sketchily going to do this morning, the liturgical significance of the cantatas, looking at them one after another. This manuscript has never been completed because his research is being frustrated by the authorities. They don't want him to do it. He's a very abrasive character, and he is all for muscular Christianity and no compromises, and he perhaps makes it difficult for himself, but he is a Christian, and he wants the state to know that he's a Christian, and so what? Pray for him. He's one of those men I have a great respect for. He works under intolerable conditions. I don't know how I would survive, but he does, and he usually comes up smiling and has a marvelous sense of humor, which is great. So Rost is a very, very important source, and there are no plans, as far as I am aware, of what is needed, actually, is a critical edition of this book, because it is this manuscript, it's so important. It's difficult to use. Charles Sanford Terry used it, you may know his book, Johann Sebastian Bach, Cantata Texts, with a reconstruction of the Leipzig liturgy. You have to use it with great care, because he's not always right. But he's more right than he is wrong. So it's still useful. He went to Leipzig and he had made a handwritten, he got somebody to copy it. So there is in London, at least there is a handwritten copy of this manuscript which you can use, but even that is difficult because the original, it's not all in Rost's hand. There were additions made later. And sometimes Terry, because Terry could only work from a manuscript copy of a manuscript, and the manuscript copy was made in the one hand, of an original was made in a variety of hands. Therefore, some of the things that Terry tells you, in fact, date from a later period than Bach's time. And we just need a critical edition, and some of us are trying to push like mad to make sure that that eventually does happen as a supplementary volume to the Neue Bachar Skaba. It's certainly needed for an understanding of the liturgical background of Bach. Okay, so all these sources are the pieces that you have to juggle with to put the jigsaw together to know what was happening on any given day. There are the registers, of course, which have not yet been fully explored, but work is beginning to be done on that, and that we are now beginning to know who was preaching when which cantata of Bach was performed. So that's going to be very interesting. And also, we know what they're preaching on, but in a sense, we don't need to look at the registers to know what was being preached, because they always preached on the gospel for the day. But you know what Lutheran pastors are. They begin with the gospel of the day, the traditional gospels, you know, the old gospels, the one-year cycle. What they do is they begin with a verse from the gospel, and then they whiz out to some other biblical verse, and then they whiz back again. And that certainly happened in Bach's day. So it's going to be very interesting to try and trace some of these sermons, which are in manuscript, but have never been looked at. Okay, that's by way of background. This is the information that you have to play with. Now, we have to go back, really, to where we left off with Luther and the two liturgies that he published, the Formula Missae, 1523, and the Deutsche Messe of 1526. And remember, there are two essential parts, the ministry of the word at the beginning with the epistle and gospel, the sermon, and the confession of faith in the creed. and the second part with which also has proclamation at its heart in the Verba Testamenti, the words of institution. And this unity that I was trying to express the other day, this unity of the two parts of the liturgy, the ministry of the word, the proclamation of the word through the reading of the word and the preaching of the word, and then the proclamation of the gospel through the words of institution, that the two parts are held together by that common proclamation. This is very important because, in the first place, the cantatas of Bach are essentially proclamation in the first part of the service. They were designed to complement the gospel for the day. And in many respects, they are sermons in sound. They pick up what the gospel teaches, and they apply that gospel teaching to the hearts and lives of the individuals who are there worshipping, which after all is what a sermon does, or at least it should do. And one of the things that happened with Bach cantatas is that when you see that there are cantatas in two parts, and it says, and some of the manuscripts do say, nach der Predigt, for the second part, after the sermon, don't fall into the way of thinking that, ah, yes, after the sermon, that is, you know, as soon as he stops, off we go with the second part of the cantata. Not so. What happens is that when the pastor is in the pulpit, he stays there, gives the notices and the general prayer, and stays in the pulpit for a long time, and then only after the general prayer, after the Lord's Prayer, does he get out, and often there was no preface or sanctus on some Sundays. So when he gets out after the prayer, you're almost straight into the Verba Testamenti. So where does the second half of the cantata come? The second part of the cantata comes as musica sub communione, music for the distribution. And one of my students has been working on a project looking at the second parts of Bach cantatas for their Eucharistic overtones. And it's there. You can see that. So that though the cantatas are originally conceived of and primarily as music of the word in the first part of the service, to go with the gospel of the day, the preaching of the day, the second part is geared to the proclamation of the gospel through the Eucharist proper itself. And if there was no second half to the cantata, we know that what happened was that bits and pieces of other cantatas were performed at that place. Recitatives and arias, particularly, were sung. If the cantata didn't have a second part, then Bach would use, there's evidence for this in the sources, that Bach would use parts from another cantata, or I guess in other places what might happen is that they might have used terebones, little cantatas, at this point, like the one that you're doing on Sunday, ideally suited for music, brief and to the point. So in a sense that the cantata was used in both halves of the worship, though primarily it is associated with the preaching and teaching of the word. Now, how did the... Sorry, go on.
I'm sorry, may I ask a question?
Sure.
Is it true that, first of all, a cantata based on Project Thyself with Gladness might have been a very commonly repeated cantata?
Yes.
Yep. And was there also a cantatas based on Wieschen Leuchtet were popular during the community?
Yes, because Wieschen Leuchtet was used as a communion hymn. Yeah.
Pretty regularly.
Very regularly. So
that might give us implications for our work that Wieschen Leuchtet has used there.
Oh, right. And if you look at Wieschen Leuchtet appeared everywhere. It was, throughout the year, and look at the Gotiwi article that I referred to the other day, and see how often, in fact, that comes up at other points in the church year. It was used very, very frequently far more frequently than we would. It's interesting. With Werner Wicke, you've been looking at actually the changes in style of the cantata. But perhaps we ought to look at the sort of the emergence of the cantata per se, liturgically. And in a sense, it links back to the, if you like, to the Deutsche Messe, where Luther, the other one, Luther gives you the formulae for singing the gospel. What develops very quickly in Lutheranism is the Evangelian motet, or Spruch motet. That is a brief piece, something like the Telemann. Telemann was in a sense standing in an older tradition with these little like the little cantata you were to do on Sunday. There is a much older tradition of setting of the key word from the gospel for the day, the key words from the gospel of the day, those key verse, you know, that enshrines the whole thing. And these were clearly sung, we're not quite sure where they were sung, at what point, but certainly around the gospel area, if you like, of the liturgy, to reinforce in a choral sense, to give an opportunity for you to dwell, meditate on the gospel for the day, and you hear the central point of that gospel for the day, and you hear it sung. And then these polyphonic settings of the key verses of the gospel for the day, they act as an introduction to the preaching of the day, because it announces, if you like, the text of the sermon very, very often. And as I say, there's a tremendous variation of how they, in fact, were used in the worship. But then what happens as time passes? The whole idea is developed, as I'm sure Vernon was telling you, that instead of just being concentrated on the Bible verse itself, then you get some devotional material being added, non-biblical verse. Meditating on the gospel for the day, and one of the most important collection of gospel motets issued between 1666 and 1668 was by Wolfgang Karl Briegel, Briegel, the immediate predecessor of Graupner in Darmstadt. And he issued these motets under the title Evangelischen Blumengarten, Gospel Flower Garden, and these are in a very simple chordal style, like much of the earlier gospel motets. And but each one ends with what Briegel calls an aria, and this is a hymn or a choral-like settings of strophic verse. And here we have another step in the developing cantata. That gradually expands its musical form in the early 18th century. We find that they are made up of biblical verses, hymn texts, devotional verse, well, it's sometimes stated that Bach's Cantata 106 is a good example of this early form, this string of biblical texts, I want to talk about this. If I can find a book in the library, and I guess it's there, a book by Olearius was the immediate source of the libretto of that cantata. So you can't really call it a typical libretto of the time, because it's lifted out of a prayer book. But maybe we'll talk about that if I can find a book in the library here a little later on. But this eventually gives way to the Reform type of cantata text, which was written by, or created by, Erdmann Neumeister, staunchly Orthodox pastor in Hamburg and a friend of Bach. You probably know the story, it's worth repeating because it's a good one, that Bach went to Hamburg to apply for the job of organist of the Jakobikirche in Hamburg, where Neumeister was the pastor. And he was producing these cantata texts, and he obviously had an eye to have Bach writing music for them. But it was customary for the successful candidate to give an enormous sum of money as a thank offering. Bach had no such financial resources. He therefore didn't get the job. On Christmas Day, I think it was, or maybe... Yeah, I think it was Christmas Day. Erwin Neumeister got into the pulpit and preached. And in the context of that sermon, he said that if the Archangel Gabriel himself had come to Hamburg and didn't have the right amount for the thank offering, he might just as well fly away again. And in that sermon there's a clear reference to Bach. Bach was immortalized in that sermon. Not mentioned by name, of course, but there was a great respect between Neumeister and Bach, and there are two volumes of Neumeister were in Bach's library, and though I can't prove it, I'm fairly certain that they were gifts from Neumeister to Bach. And again, I cannot prove it. I believe that the libretto of Cantata 79 was a gift of Bach to Neumeister, because the libretto, it's a Reformation cantata, got the hairs, the sun and is short, sun and shield, God the Lord is a sun and shield. That was the motto, the personal motto of Erwin Neumeister. Maybe Neumeister wrote the libretto of Cantata 79, but at the very least, I think there is a connection there, because it comes again and again in that cantata. And if you pick up any book by Erwin Neumeister, that motto is everywhere, on the frontispiece, on the title page, at the end of every section almost. It was his own personal motto. But it's Neumeister who creates the form of the cantata with the developed arias, recitatives and arias that Bach picks up. Now, let's attempt the actual order of the Hauptgottesdienst, the principal worship on Sundays. Now, for some reason, we're not quite sure why, but on the covers of two cantatas, both Advent cantatas, both on Nun kommt der Heidenheim, that is number 61 and 62, on the cover Bach has jotted down the detail of the service for Advent, first Sunday in Advent. And it's very, very interesting for what it gives and for what it leaves out. For those of you who are into Bach numerology, there are 14 points, but I think that's accidental. Do you know about the number symbolism? Do I have to? There is certainly evidence that Bach played with numbers. He had a lot of symbolic numbers, and that it was a game that everyone played. All of the theologians were doing it. That is, that if you take the number alphabet, A equals 1, B equals 2, C equals 3, and so on, then words have numerical values, right? And it comes from Hebrew, you see. The Hebrew language does not have numbers. So letters have to stand for numbers as well as words. So when you look at a Hebrew word, you have to work out whether it is a word or whether it's a number. Now that's what it all goes back to. And B-A-C-H is 14. And all of the theologians, I mean, there's a lot of controversy in the Bach world about this, and a lot of stupid stuff has been written, which tell us, again, more about the writers than about Bach. But it is undeniable that he did do it from time to time, but he didn't do it every time. I mean, people are trying to find numbers everywhere, and it's a reading in. You know, on Reformation Day, the gospel for the day was Revelation 14:6. There was in heaven another angel with an eternal gospel to proclaim. Well, Bugenhagen preached the sermon for Luther, and that was his text when Luther died, the funeral sermon. And Bugenhagen said that Luther is the angel who had an eternal gospel to proclaim. And you know, of course, the Weimar Bible in the early 17th century was typeset by a Catholic. That became the interpretation, the Lutheran interpretation, that angel is Luther. And the beginning of the Weimar Bible, the beginning of the 18th century, was typeset by a Catholic, and he made the verse read, there was an angel with another gospel to proclaim. And it had to be torn out, and new pages, the pages were reset. So if you've got one Bible, Weimar Bible, with that verse in that way, you have an extreme rarity. But in 1717, with the bicentennial of the Reformation, in the leading journal of the Lutheran theological journal, there was an article, and in that article it said this. It said it listed the whole verse down the left-hand side of the page. There was in heaven another angel with an eternal gospel to proclaim, and the numerical value of all those words put down beside it. Then down the right-hand side of the page, another column, a statement that, Dr. Martin Luther, Doctor of Holy Scripture, born in Eisleben, died in Eisleben, and all the rest of it. A line drawn, and whoopee, look, the numerical value is the same in both cases, therefore Luther is the angel with the gospel to proclaim. And that was, so there is a context, there is a background there, which mustn't be denied, and Bach did use it. We know that he used it, but not in the way that some people have claimed. It's very subjective. But where you can be objective and use the basic numbers that are known in Christian symbolism, like 3, 5 for the wounds of Jesus and that kind of thing, you're on much safer ground. That was all an aside. It just happens to be 14 points that he lists. There is no significance, I believe, in the 14, even though it does equal 5. Let's see if we can sort out the 7. This is what Bach, I'm sorry if you can't read my writing, I will. The service begins at 6 in the morning in the summer, 7 o'clock in the winter. Start with an organ prelude. It doesn't say what that organ prelude is. It's just preluding. Now, whether that was one of the big stuff, such as Bach would have, Bach's big preludes and fugues, whether that was one of the big preludes, we don't know. But of course, remember that who was playing the organ? It wasn't Bach. Bach was above that. He had an organist at St. Thomas's, and he had an organist at St. Nicholas. And what does that mean? That means, on a given, I can't see any other alternative. I don't know how it worked. But that means, in the morning, the cantata was in the Hauptgottesdienst in St. Thomas, say, and he had one organist to play there. In the afternoon, it was in the context of Vespers at St. Nicholas. And he had another organist to play there. Continuo. Or did he have another continuo instrument and someone else? But there is enough evidence of enough friction between Bach and the organists, not only in Leipzig, that I'm sure that those organists would have insisted on their rights, that they would have played at the service in their place. So it begins with the organ prelude. Then secondly, Latin motet. I'm giving you the order that Bach gives them on the cover of 61, BWV 61. Latin motet. The motet, usually from, there were two collections in use in Leipzig, one collected by Bodenschatz, but most often a collection by Vulpius, published at the beginning, in two parts, at the beginning of the 17th century. They're Latin motets in the old style, and they're usually on scripture verses, and linked with the teaching of the day. Not necessarily directly with the gospel, but in some way linked with the teaching of the day. And so Latin motet, whether it was entirely a cappella or whether it was accompanied by other instruments, is a matter for debate. I am inclined to believe that in the 19th century, the idea was that if it was a cappella, then there were no instruments at all, it was unaccompanied. I think the voices were doubled, my own view is, anyway. Then we have the Kyrie in its place. But on high festivals, and I'm now embroidering a little bit on Bach's order, on high festivals, it would be sung to a concerted setting. You know, we have the small masses of the Missa Brevis, so-called, misnamed, of Bach, just a Kyrie and Gloria, with orchestral accompaniment and arias and so on in form. Now, if that happened, then the Kyrie, the concerted Kyrie, would be preceded by an organ prelude. And you're beginning to see that there's a pattern developing here, and I'll be asking you questions on it as to why you think that is. There, if it's a concerted Kyrie, it is preceded by a prelude. Not a chorale prelude, necessarily, a prelude. Sometimes a Kyrie was not the plain song, the simple Kyrie eleison, Christe eleison, Kyrie eleison. Sometimes it was the hymn, the congregational hymn, Kyrie Gott Vater in Ewigkeit, which you have in your new hymn book. The Kyrie, of course, by just putting Kyrie, Bach also meant that it would also be followed by the Gloria. The two were very much kept together, Kyrie and Gloria. And again, on high festivals, it would be a concerted setting. There wouldn't be a prelude, organ prelude, to begin the Gloria, because the Gloria would follow on immediately from the Kyrie. Some Sundays it was simply chanted, the prose Latin. You can find it in Vopilius. Other times the congregational hymn, Allein Gott unter Herr sei Er, or Glory be to God on High, was sung in addition or alternatively, in place of. Then, four, you have the collect. With its verse, and that was intoned from the altar. Then the epistle. What language the epistle is in, I have not been able to actually nail down, whether it was German or whether it was Latin. It probably was in Latin only, because the sermon at Vespers, the afternoon service, was always on the epistle text, and was always preceded by the reading of the epistle in German. Then, following the epistle, on Advent Sunday, and presumably throughout Advent and throughout Lent, there is Luther's German litany. But that was an exception. I think this is one of the reasons why Bach wrote this out on the cover for Advent Sunday, because the litany did not occur that often in the church year, and it was a reminder that don't forget that there is the litany. Now, it's followed by the gradual lead, the tempora hymn of the day, which is preceded by the an organ chorale prelude, this is the hymn of the service. If you don't know the Lutheran tradition by now, you ought to. The hymn of the day, the traditional position is in the place of the gradual. I know that it comes a little later in your liturgy in Lutheran worship, but traditionally it is the gradual lead, replacing the gradual, or in addition to the gradual. In many places, the gradual was sung in plain song in Latin, not in Leipzig, but in other places it did. And it is the main hymn of the day, and it is the bridge piece that takes you into the reading of the Gospel. Then, eight, comes the Gospel. The Gospel, which is read in or sung in Latin, and immediately following the following, the Gospel 9 Cantata. You've got that, whoopee. Okay, and it will be preceded by, come on, why? Perhaps. They're already there. They're already there. They're in the West Gallery, facing down the whole length of the church. It's very neat. It's very clever. All things are done decently and in order. What, therefore, do you have to hide in the interests of not disturbing the liturgy? Tuning instruments. Right. Therefore, the cantata is introduced by preluding, which allows the instruments, the basic pitches they will hear from the organ, which also will kill the sounds that the tuning sounds that they are making. And therefore, if there is a concerted Kyrie, that too is preceded by a prelude, which allows the instruments to get up to pitch and be ready to begin the cantata without any of this hiatus. And I think that in my criticism of all the modern services which use bar cantatas, it goes along splendidly. You have everything chanted, you have the hymns introduced by choral preludes and all the rest of it. You get to the cantata and you stop. And you hear, ay, ay, ay. And it has to be done, and everybody switches off, you know. And okay, we're ready. Off we go. And in some sense, you see, that liturgically you have interrupted the flow of the worship. They knew what they were doing. This isn't, I mean, in a sense, it is soaking, it's blotting paper music, you could argue. You know, it's soaking up the sounds. But it is doing so for a liturgical purpose. It is a genuine bridge piece that is there in order to make the necessary preparations so that there is no interruption in the flow of the liturgy, so that everyone is ready musically then. You see, this was the function of the chorale prelude. The chorale prelude did two things. It reminded the congregation of the shape of the melody. And if it's a well-known melody, then the organist can go all over the place because he needs only just slightly hint at it because everyone knows what's coming. But the main function is to end on the leading note so that we all come in, bang, straight away. And that was the same kind of idea for the instrumentalists and the choir too. See it. It's unprepared. You know, it's straight in, isn't it? If you have the prelude, then you have established your pitch and your basic notes.
We're assuming that we have evidence that that prelude would always be the key of the beginning of it.
No, we don't. I mean, we can't say, you know, that was it. But, I mean, there's enough evidence that that was the function of it, and therefore it must be. I mean, I can't point you to an absolute sentence that says, you know, we do this because, but yeah. Again, for musical reasons. And if you've been in another key somewhere else, you need to establish the new key that you're going to shoot off from. Very functional, but very necessary. It's one of those little details which I think is very important. They knew what they were doing. Everything has to flow and develop from one to the next without disturbing but encouraging the congregation to worship. That's one of the reasons why I think there are good acoustic reasons why the musicians should be at the back of the church. But visually, they have to move. You can't produce music if you're rigid. And if that is at the front of the church, that is very distracting. So by putting them at the back and above, acoustically it works beautifully because the sound just rolls down the whole of the church building. especially in these tall Gothic buildings. But also, it means that it is there is no distraction, visual distraction, for the congregation, unless they're craning around, of course. Okay. Then follows the confession of faith in the Creed, Luther's Via Glauben. We all believe in one true God. And you're beginning to see the pattern that is developing here, that you have the teaching, the preaching, the teaching, and the reading and the teaching and preaching of the word in the epistle, the gradual lead picks up the main teaching of the day in the gospel, the cantata. There is the response, immediate response to the cantata of the whole congregation joining together and in the creed and confessing their faith. And then follows the sermon. Sometimes Via Glauben was not replaced, but sometimes the Latin credo was sung, either straight, the straight prose was chanted by the choir, sometimes it was a large concerted setting, and I can't tell you which, nobody knows, but the credo of the B minor Mass was sung at that point, at some very special service. We don't know which one it was. The B minor Mass was never written to be performed in one complete whole. It's four distinct sections. There is the Missa, the Kyrie and Gloria, then there's the Credo, and so on. And they were all the four different parts, sections, were used on different occasions. That is very clear. Let's not get off on that, but there's so much that could be said about it. Then comes the sermon, and the sermon is preceded. The sermon is in German. It's a good poetic couplet. And it is preceded by the reading of the Gospel in German. So you've got the pattern. The epistle was read in Latin, but then later on at the Vespers service, it was read in German. When you come to the Gospel is sung, or rather, as the epistle was sung too, but it's Latin, is the language. But when it comes to the sermon, which will be on the Gospel, the sermon is preceded by by the reading of the Gospel of the day in German. It is also preceded, and Bach doesn't record this, it is preceded by a pulpit hymn. A verse of a hymn comes in at that point too. And the sermon is always on the Gospel for the day. The cantata is always on the Gospel for the day. And you can see that in this first part of the liturgy, everything is working together and everything is centered upon the Gospel. The liturgical climax is the reading of the Gospel. And the cantata and the sermon are expositions of the main teaching of the Gospel for the day. They are also applications of the Gospel of the day. In other words, in some sense, a good sermon, if it is on the Gospel of the day, should have within it, or should create, a response on the part of the worshipping congregation. That's the whole point of preaching. You don't just simply say, this is the Gospel, period. This is the Gospel, and this is the response that we should make. Largely the response of faith. The cantatas do the same. In musical form. They say that this is what the Gospel is, this is the teaching of today, and this is the response that we should make. And this is confirmed by the position of the Creed, which is the confession of faith, a confirmation. We have heard the Gospel read, we have heard it expound musically, we're about to have it expound verbally, and we make our response. We believe. And it's very important, this whole, and every cantata of Bach fits into that pattern. Every cantata is confessional in that sense, that it has to do with confessing the faith that is expressed in the Gospel of Christ, and very closely linked to the Gospel of the day, and very closely linked with the sermon. And it is very clear that the libretti of Bach's cantatas were carefully chosen. He Bach would choose them, and then he would send them, or choose possibilities of libretti, and would send them to Dailing, the superintendent minister, who would confer with whoever was to preach at the service, and they would together choose which one is the most appropriate, bearing in mind the sermon that was to be preached, the direction that the sermon was going to go in, and then Bach would then compose according to that. So it was you know, there was very close cooperation with the preachers, because they understood that they're in the same business. One of them using words, the other using music, and words as well, but you know what I mean. And it is essentially preaching through music. Then after the sermon as such, after the preaching bit, but before the minister gets out, then there is a hymn verse, and then the general prayer. In between the hymn verse that marks the end of the preaching as such, but he stays in the pulpit, and the general prayer, the pastor would give the announcements, who's died, who's going to get married, and what are your pledges for this week, or whatever the notices were. They didn't do that, actually, but that kind of thing. Whatever that had to be said was said at that point. And you see, who was ill? Who has died? Who is ill? Who has been baptized? The information you need before you go into the general prayer. And that was done at that point. Then, on Advent Sunday, we go straight to the Verba Testamenti. That means on Advent Sunday, how long have I got, Al? Okay, I will rush, but I'll be able to pick this up afterwards. This means that on Advent Sunday, there was no Preface and Sanctus, but we know that on other occasions they certainly did have that. This is what I mean, that the jigsaw is very complicated. In outline, it's very easy. In detail, for particular Sundays, there are all kinds of anomalies that are very difficult to sort out. Then 14, the last thing that he met, but it isn't the last thing of the service, it became time to part two, if there is one, or the second cantata element, if you like, for musica sal communione, the music during the distribution, and that will be preceded by an organ prelude, again, for the obvious reason. And then, if necessary, and Bach doesn't note this, but we know this happened, then what happens is that the singing of hymns, communion hymns, and they were not announced beforehand, they're only announced by the chorale prelude. Okay? Because they were all familiar. And these hymns and chorale preludes were alternated until the time for the distribution had been completed. Then that's all Bach gives you, because I think that all the rest of it is straightforward. There is a thanksgiving collect and a blessing, and then finally an organ postlude, which is part of the worship, not an optional extra, as indeed the prelude is. But perhaps we can pick that up next, when we at the beginning of the next session.